Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. And on behalf of NJOHSP, I'd like to welcome you all here to the February edition of the monthly intelligence webinar. For those of you who had tuned in last month, we had gone over our annual threat assessment. And one of the themes that we mentioned was sort of a driver for our analysis was the conflict between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And so what we decided to do is really we thought that subject needed to go into that a little more, provide a little more context, and be able to answer some more questions specifically on that. So that's what sort of drove us to use this as the subject for today's Intel webinar. And I think you will find it very informative. So our presenters today, we have two of our analysts here today, Jenna Raymond and Angie Gadd. They are our Al-Qaeda or AQ and ISIS analysts respectively. And they've had a very busy year, to say the least, as they've been sort of tracking both these groups and how they interact with each other and additionally sort of what that means, both sort of in the larger scale and what that means for us in the U.S. So I guess we just start at the beginning. Why don't you two talk to us a little bit about what are these two groups? What, if anything, are, you know, makes them different from each other?
So I'm going to start off a little bit with providing everyone with a background on the origins of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. So the group is originally an Iraqi organization. It grew out of Al-Qaeda, and it traces its roots back to the late 1990s. But ISIS, as we know it today, took shape really in 2004, which is when the group's leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. A little bit about the differences. So ISIS is primarily, and at first has a localist focus. So it aims its effort at what it labels apostate regimes in the Middle East and fueling sectarian tensions. Now we're seeing that starting to shift a little with an increased interest in carrying out spectacular attacks against the West. The group's main goal is remaining and expanding the territory currently under its control in Iraq and Syria, but it also has a global expansionist vision. ISIS, while it is strategic, is almost always in the now and wants immediate change. And we saw this with the establishment of the caliphate in 2014. I'm going to speak about that a little later on.
When we look at Al-Qaeda, I think it's important to sort of look at what they want and how they're trying to get it. Al-Qaeda, like ISIS, believes that a global caliphate should exist. But Al-Qaeda thinks it's going to happen at a later date. It needs to be approached and created in what is called the prophetic method. That's Ayman al-Zawahiri. That's what he calls it, the prophetic method. And it really just involves support and consensus of Muslims. And he says that ISIS has not done that. And then if you look at how Al-Qaeda is trying to get to a caliphate, they've been using a franchising strategy, which is probably not the greatest way to go about growing your organization. There's just a lot of downfalls to it. Al-Qaeda Central doesn't have complete control over all of their affiliates. The affiliates almost always remain concerned with like small regional and local issues. And then when an affiliate fails, it can be really embarrassing for the central group, and it ultimately becomes their failure.
So just out of curiosity, when we're talking about these two groups, is it fair to say that from an outsider's point of view, that they are, at least ideologically, almost the same? They're two shades of the same color. Is that fair to say?
Yes, yeah. Definitely. The two groups follow the same ideology, puritanical extremist perversion of Islam, that's labeled jihadi Salafism. Both groups also have the same tactic. They prey and exploit on instability in Muslim-majority countries to achieve their goals.
And yet, how would you characterize, if you could, in one or two words, the depth of their competition? Is it, you know, a friendly rivalry? Is it, to the death? How would you guys describe that?
I definitely would not call it friendly.
No, not friendly.
I think they're fighting for sort of, to be the vanguard of the global jihadi movement. They both want to be in charge and carry this caliphate into existence. And you can only have one group doing that.
Awesome. So talking about the vanguard of the global jihadi movement, let's talk about what they're battling for. So Angie, why don't you go first?
Yeah, so just like Jenna said, they are fighting for that title. They want to be the vanguard of the global jihadist movement. ISIS is trying to brand itself as the new face of jihad or the future of jihad. So they tried to make it apparent that they are, in fact, the true heir to Osama bin Laden's legacy, in a sense indicating that Al-Qaeda has lost its way and ISIS is here to finish what bin Laden started. Both groups are actively trying to recruit followers or supporters in the West, either to travel and join or to carry out attacks on their behalf.
I think when we look at Al-Qaeda, they're really battling for authority. They have always seen themselves as the global vanguard of the jihadi movement, and the rise of ISIS has really put that into question. And they really want to claim, you know, jihadi hegemony through gaining territory, recruits, homegrown violent extremists, and having a presence in the Syrian conflict. In terms of territory, we've seen AQAP and the Nusra Front both mired in regional conflicts, trying to win and consolidate territory, likely as a response to ISIS's controlled territory. When we look at recruits and HVEs, obviously you need recruits and soldiers to populate an organization that's going to have operational capabilities. In terms of HVEs, even just a public arrest of someone who maybe even hasn't been able to carry out attack is really a win for the organization because it shows that people are being influenced by what they're doing. And then by engaging in the Syrian conflict through the Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda can demonstrate that it's still a stakeholder in international issues.
It also sort of looks like it's set up almost like a generational battle. Is that accurate to say where AQ are sort of the guys from the 1980s?
Like the old guard.
Afghan. Yeah. And the, yeah. I mean, that's sort of the impression again that the ISIS guys are they're the guys on Twitter and Instagram and they're sort of the jihadi hipster guys. Now, I mean, is that accurate? Are the people who are running ISIS sort of those young punks or maybe that's not right. Are they the young guns or, you know, how much of this is branding and how much of this is actual generational?
So with who's running ISIS, they're definitely not younger. I think the core leadership obviously is older, but they have been able to capitalize on social media and technology to brand the group and to reach a broader demographic in a way that Al-Qaeda, I believe, has failed to do. Jen, I think so Al-Qaeda is more of like the old guard.
Yeah, I mean, I think ISIS, their leaders have just realized that there's new methods of media they can use to reach people. And for whatever reason, Al-Qaeda just hasn't realized it or for some reason doesn't want to embrace that. I mean, throughout late 2014 until August 2015, we didn't hear anything from Zawahiri. He was silent for almost a year. Finally, in August 2015, he issued a statement regarding the Taliban's leader. Then in September and October, he released a series of 6 audio messages he called the Islamic Spring. I'm not exactly sure what he was thinking, releasing something called the Islamic Spring in the autumn, but I don't really want to get into the nitty-gritty, but looking at some analysis of the actual content, he spends almost half of his original remarks making derogatory comments and criticizing ISIS. He only mentions attacking in the West 9 times, and 2 of those 9 specifically mention the United States. Mm-hmm. So in 3 hours of audio, he only talks about attacking the United States twice. He's trying to make a priority out of painting ISIS as this illegitimate jihadi group, and he's really concerned about the possibility of ISIS eclipsing Al-Qaeda, but he still doesn't know how to sort of reverse that social media trend.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about that they're engaged in this battle. Can we talk a little more about where is this battle being fought and maybe how it's being fought?
Yeah, so Jenna and myself identified 3 broad forms for the battle. So we broke down into local, global, and propaganda. Jenna spoke a little bit about the propaganda just now. So to break it down, so for local, on the ground, we have seen ISIS and Al-Qaeda's affiliates, specifically the Nusra Front, fight it out on the ground in Syria. We've seen them fight it out in Yemen, Afghanistan, even parts of North Africa as well. Locally or on the ground level, the distinction between the two groups plays a major role. However, the line will get a little blurred when it comes to when you look at individuals that are spying by the groups. I'm going to riff off this a little bit. The distinction between the two groups when it comes to supporters abroad doesn't matter so much. So we've seen a number of cases where homegrown violent extremists in the U.S. or supporters in the West come together to plot or carry out an attack. We've seen these several cases where someone will carry out an attack and claim that it's inspired by ISIS, but later we find that they were listening to Anwar al-Awlaki recordings and they had Inspire magazines. So just to show that a little bit that on the ground it matters, but sometimes abroad it really doesn't for their supporters. Globally, Did you want to talk about the...
Yeah, I can talk about Boko. Like Angie said, we have ISIS and Al-Qaeda groups in Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, and North Africa. And sometimes there are, like, literal physical battles occurring, but sometimes they're sort of fighting a mutual enemy in, a zero-sum game. For example, in Syria, if the Nusra Front takes over a village from President Assad's forces, that village... You know, ISIS can't have it unless they want to fight them for it. So maybe they don't always directly fight, but they're competing for territory and resources.
And then globally, there is a battle between ISIS and Al-Qaeda and consists mostly of the two competing to carry out spectacular attacks internationally. So we're seeing ISIS again, like I mentioned, shift from that localist focus by trying to compete with Al-Qaeda to conduct a 9/11 style attack against the West. So this change in strategy we've seen materialize with a string of attacks. Obviously, we saw this with the Paris attacks in November and with the downing of the Russian jetliner in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula in October. Now to get to the last point, propaganda. So ISIS has a very concentrated anti-Al-Qaeda propaganda campaign. It's very telling and it speaks to how much ISIS views its former parent organization as a thorn in its side. So this campaign takes form in several ways. There are targeted efforts, mostly through videos, that attempt to co-opt or sway Al-Qaeda franchises to join ISIS. Now there's another form, and this has been repeated criticism and undermining of Al-Qaeda in several of ISIS's English language magazine, Debiq. So it indicates a slight obsession with their rival. In their most recent issue, Debiq 13, ISIS consistently denounces Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, for having too soft of an approach with Shia Muslims and not enough criticism of the Saudi regime's execution of 40 jihadists, for example. And it was calling on its supporters to outdo Al-Qaeda by killing Saudi clerics. Just an example of some of the propaganda ISIS has been putting out against Al-Qaeda.
And then with propaganda too, I mean, we've heard so much about social media supporters, particularly of ISIS, but do we also get the sense, I'm kind of setting you up here because I kind of know the answer to this question, but can you talk a little bit about how individual sort of sympathizers are sort of taking part in that propaganda battle, right? Like, so when Zawahiri says something, don't sort of like ISIS fanboys kind of mock him online and vice versa? Does that sort of trolling battles occur?
Yeah, it happens more on the part of ISIS. You'll have regular, you know, ISIS sympathizers who will just sort of start, you know, saying derogatory things about Al-Qaeda. On Al-Qaeda's end, it's more formal. I mean, Zawahiri will say critical things about ISIS in his, you know, official audio messages, but you don't get a lot of like Al-Qaeda fanboys online saying, doing the same thing to ISIS.
It's also interesting when you see these like Twitter fights break out between jihadis online. What's funny is they will start to target Al-Qaeda or Zawahiri once they're prompted or once they see something put up by ISIS. But what we don't see is they don't necessarily, or I haven't seen them targeting Bin Laden. So Bin Laden's kind of like, it's taboo. They don't touch Bin Laden because he's seen as the father of all of this. So they will criticize Al-Qaeda, but they won't criticize the older Al-Qaeda that ISIS kind of grew out of to begin with.
Yeah, their criticism is all current.
Current.
Mm-hmm. And don't they say they're very have favorable things to say about Anwar al-Awlaki as well.
Yes. Of course, yeah. He's very charismatic figure that resonates with a lot of the supporters. We've seen overlap with Anwar al-Awlaki and people reading things out of Debiq. That's definitely normal.
Excellent. So what is the state of play? We've talked about these two groups are in a competition for a while. You know, if you were scoring this in a way, who's ahead?
So currently, ISIS is definitely a few steps ahead. You can look at this kind of like a marathon where ISIS is ahead and a fatigue and sweaty Al-Qaeda is constantly lagging several steps behind, desperately trying to catch up. ISIS has beat Al-Qaeda to the punch by establishing, or more accurately, they restored the caliphate in 2014, which has been a long-held goal by many extremist groups, specifically Al-Qaeda, but as Jenna mentioned, it's more of a long-term goal that they had, generational, nothing immediate. Since the establishment of the caliphate, ISIS has demonstrated its ability and capacity to compete with Al-Qaeda on an international scale. So when we're looking at, you know, who has the upper hand in this battle, just to draw everyone a picture, so ISIS is stronger and more dominant in the Levant, Libya, Caucasus, West Africa, and then you have Al-Qaeda's more dominant and stronger in the Maghrib, Sahel, Horn of Africa, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia. That's not to say that ISIS isn't trying to gain a foothold in Al-Qaeda's strongholds, but it definitely does have followers and supporters in those areas.
Like Angie said, Al-Qaeda has a multi-generational plan, and while they definitely don't like it, I think they accept that they're going to have setbacks and periods of low activity. I mean, Al-Qaeda looks at the establishment of a caliphate as an absolute eventuality, but I think they're comfortable with sort of this slow and steady wins the race. But at the same time, they're obviously frustrated, and it's unnerving to see a group like ISIS find such a large level of success so quickly.
So Al-Qaeda's behind a couple steps. What does it take for them to get back at least to parity, if not sort of beating ISIS?
Well, definitely a 9/11 style large spectacular attack is a surefire way for Al-Qaeda to pick up some steam, but it just seems so very unlikely that they have the capability to do so. The Khorasan group, which was Al-Qaeda's version of the A-team, you know, it was meant to be this advanced team of veteran Al-Qaeda fighters planning attacks in the West and against Western assets. But in 2015, we saw several of their leaders killed in drone strikes and other military operations. And so just the Khorasan group and really all of the affiliates, their resources are engaged in regional conflicts. They're just unlikely to have the capability to plan large attacks, much less actually carry them out. However, the affiliates are all getting a lot of experience very quickly, which could set them up to be a more capable group in the future in terms of operations.
So would it be accurate to say that, at least in the short term, best way, or maybe the most likely way for Al-Qaeda to gain momentum or regain, you know, number one position would be for ISIS to have some sort of something bad happen to them?
But
I mean, mostly be able to take advantage of it, of something that happens bad to ISIS rather than them do something proactively.
Yeah. And I do think Al-Qaeda is, certainly they're hoping for something terrible to happen to ISIS's capabilities. And I think they're likely ready to take advantage of that.
Even, I mean, territorially or capability-wise, those are all very important. I was looking at it more from a smaller scale. So ISIS defectors, there have been a lot that came out, spoke out against the reasons why they left the group, the brutality, the group's indiscriminate killing of other Muslims. And more importantly, they're not implementing Islam properly, and they've been given examples of the group's blatant hypocrisies. Many of the defectors are still radical, ideologically motivated, and determined to carry out jihad. However, ISIS is no longer palatable for their jihadi taste, or ISIS is just too extreme for these individuals. So this could definitely, I see this being a potential win for Al-Qaeda, with an increase in former ISIS fighters could likely join Al-Qaeda's ranks.
So I thought one of those stories was interesting. When we talk about even defectors, there's a couple of notable ones. The one in this report that was put out a month or two ago, this guy sort of left ISIS. He was still an extremist, though, and his objection was that they were killing too many Sunni Muslims. Mm-hmm. He had no problem with
killing,
sort of executing Shia Muslims and Christians all the time, but it was like the line was drawn because they were killing Sunnis as well.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. Another gentleman, I don't know if you want to talk about him, just sort of within what you've talked about here, who's on Twitter. He's a reformed ISIS guy. I don't want to say reformed. Let's say he left ISIS and is now in Finland.
Yeah.
Do you want to just talk about him and where you think he fits on that ideological spectrum now, even though he's left the group?
Yeah, so we've been looking at his tweets, and he had a very influential account. He had a lot of followers, and he defected, and now he's anti-ISIS. But he's still radical. So he was still supporting jihad in an Islamic state, just not the way ISIS is implementing it. So he'll still defend pledging allegiance to a caliphate, just not ISIS right now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda and ISIS are Sunni-based.
Yeah.
Organizations.
They're both Sunni.
And they sort of vary a little bit in terms of their opposition to Shia, but ISIS is more anti-Shia than AQ, at least for right now. Is that fair to say?
We're gonna speak to that in a minute.
Okay. So one of the questions that we frequently get is, these used to be the same group, or at least used to be affiliated. Now they're split. What is the likelihood that these guys are going to reunite the band and get together again?
Probably none.
Yeah, this band is not getting back together. No, I mean, Zawahiri has said publicly many times that he really values global jihadi unity. He's said that some of the actions taken by ISIS, he completely opposes, but they can be forgiven. ISIS militants are redeemable, and they can move toward a better path. I think some people have looked at this and seen it as some sort of overture of cooperation by Zawahiri, but I think cooperation could really only occur if ISIS agrees to be subordinate to Al-Qaeda, which really isn't cooperation at all. It's Al-Qaeda getting a new affiliate.
Yeah, so knowing ISIS, that's not how the group wouldn't operate. They would not consent to being Al-Qaeda's subordinate in any way, at least in the near future. So, yeah.
Since that's unlikely to happen, what happens? Certainly, both Baghdadi and Zawahiri have got to be high on the target list of a whole bunch of different people. What do you think would happen to this sort of dynamic of competition in the event that one of these guys dies, is incapacitated, retires, whatever?
Right now with Al-Qaeda, it doesn't appear that they have someone who's second in command or anyone. They haven't agreed upon anyone who can run Al-Qaeda if Zawahiri were to die. For a few years, it was understood that Nasir al-Wahishi, the former AQAP leader, was the heir apparent, but he was killed last year in a drone strike. I think if Zawahiri died tomorrow, it's likely there would be, at least for a time, the decision on who would be the next leader would be contested. Initially, I think the big three, which as I like to call them, the big three are Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and the Nusra Front, I think they would stick together. They've issued joint statements in the past when Zawahiri was absent from messaging, and it's likely that they can still, at least for the foreseeable future, benefit from one another. I think the big three would end up pulling rank on Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab would probably not have a lot of input into who would be a new leader, and they would maybe they would go out on their own, or they would wholesale go to ISIS. I think Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, they have very little capability, and I mean, really, they can't do much of anything, so they would probably stay with the big three in hopes of getting some kind of benefits they can't get on their own. And I guess this is a little bit of speculation that depends on a lot of other things, but I could see, depending on what happens in the Syrian conflict, I could see the Nusra Front at some point needing to go it alone or at least have a greater amount of autonomy from AQAP and AQIM.
There's been rumors about the Nusra Front ditching Al-Qaeda
Yeah.
on and off.
It seems like those rumors, whenever they kind of crop up, they're fueled by rumors that they could maybe get a lot of funding from a Middle Eastern country to keep fighting in the Syrian conflict. So it wouldn't necessarily be ideological or operational differences. It would just come down to business. They can get more money.
With respect to ISIS and the death of their leader, so their leader is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, there have been experts that have come out saying the death of Zawahiri or Baghdadi would lead to the two groups merging. I disagree. I believe that it'll take more than just the death of either two leaders for the two groups to come together. So Baghdadi has taken measures to sort of secure against and to guarantee the continuity of the group in the event of his death or the death of any of his top commanders. So there is a number two guy. There have been many of ISIS's top commanders, and those even directly under Baghdadi, have been killed since September 2014. Currently, there is a right-hand man. The individual right under Baghdadi is a guy by the name Abu Ali al-Anbari. Whether or not he's being groomed to replace Baghdadi is unclear. However, I also have another kind of idea. I draw this historical parallel as to what would possibly happen in the event of Baghdadi's death if ISIS wasn't able to kind of secure the succession seamlessly. So I draw a historical parallel to the events that took place following the death of the Prophet Muhammad. These events were called the Ridda Wars, or translated, the Wars of Apostasy. So these wars were initiated by the first caliph, Abu Bakr. What happened was, once the Prophet Muhammad passed away, many of the alliances he made with certain tribal chiefs were at risk of breaking their pledges. And some even rejected the prophet. They rejected that he was ever a prophet. So Abu Bakr conducted a series of military campaigns called the Ridda Wars to rope everyone back in. Now, many of these tribes were defeated, and Abu Bakr was successfully able to bring them back into the fold of the caliphate. Now, I'm definitely not in any way equating Baghdadi to the Prophet Muhammad, but knowing ISIS, they draw heavily on emulating themselves based on Islam during the times of the Prophet. And I can see them framing a post-Baghdadi ISIS in the same context if they're faced with similar responses from their affiliates or supporters or provinces.
So when we talk about followers and we talk about affiliates and things like that, one concept that seems pretty important is the concept of bay'ah, which is sort of a swearing of allegiance, both sort of at an individual level and at sort of a group level. So if you guys could talk about what that term means generally, but also sort of what it means for each one of these groups and how much weight does it actually carry? So is it just something you say like, yeah, okay, I'm on your team, or no, is it a big deal like when you do that?
Swearing bay'ah or swearing allegiance, I think it is a big deal. I mean, usually it's one leader pledges allegiance to another leader, and it's supposed to be for life. You know, when Osama bin Laden died, all of the affiliates and allied groups had to re-swear allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri. Since Al-Qaeda has sort of decided to go for this franchise model of expansion, whenever another terrorist group pledges allegiance to first bin Laden and then subsequently Zawahiri, it really speaks to a continuity of trust and faith in the direction that Al-Qaeda is going. It can show strength in terms of the number of smaller groups that line up to be subordinate. But like I mentioned earlier this afternoon, it also can make the central group look extremely foolish. foolish if one of the affiliates fails or ends up, you know, scuttling away from central group. When Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group originally pledged allegiance to Osama bin Laden in 2004, it ended up being kind of a mess for Al-Qaeda Central. Even though they got this huge presence in Iraq at a time when bin Laden and Zawahiri really needed to keep a low profile, Zarqawi was incredibly violent, he was indiscriminate in his use of violence, and he was actually warned by Al-Qaeda Central leaders that he was making them look bad. So, you know, if you're a terrorist organization, you know, and your parent group tells you you're being too extreme, you're really taking things too far. So if we fast forward a decade, and now we see groups breaking allegiance from Zawahiri to throw their support to Baghdadi, it's essentially a vote of no confidence in Zawahiri's leadership, and really the entire Al-Qaeda network, because it essentially puts their vision of jihadi hegemony in serious jeopardy.
So there is some sort of a way, even though you swear this allegiance and it's supposed to be to death, there are loopholes that allow you to sort of break that, right?
Yeah, we saw that with ISIS when Baghdadi became the group's leader in 2010. He left that open without re-swearing bay'ah to Zawahiri, and that they gave them kind of a window there.
Well, that's contested.
Yeah.
Zawahiri says that Baghdadi pledged allegiance.
Yeah, we can go back and forth on that one. But for ISIS as well, getting pledges of allegiance is very important, especially when the group was, once the group established caliphate, it was trying to transform itself from a local jihadi group based just in Iraq and Syria to an international brand. It's contingent on expanding its jihadi hegemony or global expansionist vision through global pledges of allegiance. So ISIS's main goal is to establish that global caliphate, like we mentioned. And the most effective way to do that is to gain affiliates in established provinces across the globe. And ISIS has already done this through existing jihadi networks and relied both on either unaligned extremist factions in different countries or by targeting existing Al-Qaeda affiliates, causing them either to splinter. So we saw within some Al-Qaeda groups, a few number of the members or leaders would splinter off, or the group would fully pledge allegiance to ISIS, as we saw with Boko Haram. ISIS currently has 19 wilayat or provinces in Iraq and Syria, and it has 10 provinces in the Middle East, North Africa, West Africa, and Central Asia total. The most significant battle that I see when it comes to ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the competition between them over affiliates, has been over elements within Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and Pakistan's the TTP.
This is probably something to keep in mind, right? Is just because they say that they have a Saudi Arabian province.
It
that
could be a couple member. Yeah.
Yeah.
That in no way means that they own Saudi Arabia, right?
No, definitely not.
No, yeah, definitely not. I mean, I think their primary provinces, the ones I can say are the strongest, are obviously Iraq and Syria, which is their primary area of operations. Then you have Libya, which is huge. That would, I think, would be their second one right after Iraq and Syria. Then obviously not all of Egypt, not Egypt proper, but only Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Boko Haram is very present and active in West Africa as well. To a lesser extent, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Algeria, and the Afghan-Pakistan region.
So let's talk about governing. How does each one of these groups operate in terms of the territory they control? How do they treat civilians? How do they run things?
Well, I mean, let's just be clear. It's no picnic living under either of these groups' rule. But, I mean, there are some differences.
Yeah, ISIS has a very clearly defined hierarchical structure. They're a centralized organization. The group is a full-fledged state. They're able to provide a wide array of state services, this specifically in its proto-state, so its de facto capital in Raqqa in Syria. So they do everything from rebuilding roads to providing healthcare to issuing parking tickets. This is not to say that all operations are seamless, but just to give you all an example of all the kind of services they provide for the residents. However, the primary mechanism of maintaining control over the territory has been the group's very harsh and rigid implementation of laws, or what I like to call cold turkey Sharia law. And it also has very aggressive forms of punishment. Some examples, so they've outlawed men wearing skinny jeans. They've outlawed people listening to music. People aren't allowed to smoke cigarettes, even though ISIS fighters are smoking cigarettes. That's not the point. So anyone caught doing any of this is sent to jail. They've even outlawed Nike products because the word is mildly familiar or similar to an explicit word in Arabic. They've also implemented very extreme and brutal forms of punishment against civilians. So we've seen this obviously with their beheading videos, symbolic crucifixions, public lashings. They throw alleged homosexuals off of buildings in very public display and through videos. The group has absolutely no leniency. I want to also touch on a main point of contention between ISIS and Al-Qaeda and how they treat Shia civilians. So ISIS targets Shias and calls for their supporters abroad and followers to attack Shias or areas with heavy Shia populations. Conversely, Zawahiri specifically issued orders to senior commanders and fighters to not target Shia civilians.
Al-Qaeda has been a little bit more gradual in how it wants to implement Sharia law, because it definitely does want to live under Sharia law, but they likely learned a lesson from Zarqawi's cold turkey Sharia law in Iraq in 2004-2005. But, I mean, we found documents from AQIM in Africa showing that the group actually planned out how to gradually introduce their version of Sharia law in areas where they had enough of a foothold to influence people's daily lives. In the past year, we've seen similar actions from AQAP in Yemen. I don't really want to use the word moderate when we're talking about terrorists, but it appears as though Al-Qaeda is determined to present itself as a more reasonable organization when compared to ISIS, as well as taking on a winning hearts and minds kind of strategy regarding those it means to rule. And not to say that Al-Qaeda doesn't dole out severe punishment, because they certainly do, but in terms of everyday life, it appears as though there's more leniency, and that Al-Qaeda Central and the affiliates are prepared for periods of adjustment when they're implementing Sharia. And I'm pretty sure you can still smoke cigarettes.
So just on that point, it's actually reminding me of how Al-Qaeda's model is more like historical Islam when they introduced all the laws of banning alcohol. It was gradual.
Yeah, because when alcohol was banned, wasn't it sort of in like three different steps?
It was in increments, yeah. And also like limiting his pre-Islamic Arabia, they could marry an unlimited number of wives. They slowly began to downgrade to four, so that it wasn't cold turkey, but it was more of a...
Yeah, this it was is what gradual.
Gradual, yeah. So that people can adjust and not turn them away from the religion right away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But let's talk about now, what would be game changers that would upset the dynamic? It appears, tell me if I'm wrong, it appears that at least over the past year or so, things have sort of settled into a stalemate between these two groups. What would you expect to see, or perhaps better question, if the people listening in now, if they wake up one morning and they see, what would they need to see in the headline where they go, uh-oh, this means things are going to really change now?
Mm-hmm. Sure. From Al-Qaeda, I think there's sort of three main game changers. The first would be if Al-Qaeda could pull off a second 9/11 type of attack. But like we said earlier, this seems very unlikely for the foreseeable future. Right now, their best bet is to probably advocate and try to inspire sympathizers in the West to attack at home. But honestly, they haven't even been doing that recently in any of their propaganda. A second game changer that we've already discussed this afternoon was if Zawahiri dies without an agreed upon successor. I think we'd see a change in the general makeup of the network. But again, I think the big three would stick together, at least initially. And if they could agree upon a leader who's both charismatic and aggressive enough to ramp up operations in a manner in which they could actually be successful, I think in the next several years we could see, you know, a complete 180 from Al-Qaeda. But again, that's a lot of what ifs and a lot of intermediary steps would have to happen. Third, and this is probably the largest potential game changer, if we had a significant military intervention in the Syrian conflict that could both destroy ISIS and remove the Assad regime from Syria, but ended up leaving the Nusra Front largely intact.
Pretty big goals.
those are some big goals. But I mean, essentially then you'd have an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria that would be unopposed by any rival groups and could actually maybe take part in, you know, forming a new Syria.
Yeah, one of the major game changers I see for ISIS is the fall of its de facto capital, Raqqa. So Raqqa is really the group's stronghold in its proto-state. The implications of the loss could result in increased and more violent attacks against the West. We've seen this in the past. ISIS increases its external operations or attacks overseas outside its primary area of operations in the event of military or territorial losses at home to just increase momentum. I mean, another way of looking at it, it could play it into its apocalyptic narrative if it's starting to lose Raqqa, for example, and stating that that loss is sort of part of the straight struggle, and it only further undermines the group's narrative. Another game changer, again, like Jenna said, if ISIS were to carry out a 9/11 style attack, which I think is very unlikely, if not impossible, but very difficult in our current security environment and with respect to ISIS capabilities in attacking at least the United States. Lastly, again, boots on the ground to fight ISIS by US or a coalition of forces would likely quicken or speed up the group's decline territorially. Also, I believe that its international appeal would start to dwindle with its supporters and sympathizers overseas if it starts to see the group losing so much ground. In this event, I would see ISIS reverting back to sort of its insurgency roots that we saw it come out of in 2004.
So we used the term a lot, jihadist, in here.
Yeah.
And I know going back to last year, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what term we wanted to use as sort of shorthand to describe these folks. Mm-hmm. And it isn't entirely accurate to give this label to these folks. There's a lot of other meanings for that. So could you talk a little bit about that process that we went through, where we came up, why we decided to use that label, what maybe some of the alternatives were we considered, and sort of what we use maybe more officially?
Sure. We did have this discussion, I believe, the first day I started work here. So jihad, yeah. So the word jihad in Arabic means struggle, not necessarily in a bad way, just struggle to be a better Muslim. And obviously war or battle is the last resort. And the word for war is actually not jihad in the Quran. It's a different term. So you're right. The word jihad is not accurate. I would like to use a different word, and that is kharijites. So kharijites historically are Muslims. Well, that's a loose term. Individuals who broke away from the predominant group of Muslims at the time during Muhammad's time and following, obviously, who implemented very extreme measures, extreme punishments, very almost exactly similar to ISIS today. And I spoke with Dean about using that label, but it's such a, first, it's very hard to pronounce. Second, it's not recognized, the word kharijite, so you'd have to explain the historical context, and it would have to be introduced, and it would take a while for that word to pick up. But we decided to use jihadist or extremist or radical because it's the one that's most recognized at this time. I would love for the word kharijites to be put out there and to start labeling specifically ISIS with that term. I think it's very fitting, and you can even search up the term.
And then in our products too, we have gone to sort of using the term Salafi jihadist.
Yeah.
Which we think is a little more accurate in applying here. But yeah, so when we're talking though back and forth, a lot of times it's just in terms of shorthand. We revert back to sort of the slightly lazy tactics of just jihadist. So
yeah, jihadi Salafism is more accurate and nuanced when you're talking about jihadist versus jihadi Salafism is better because it specifically pinpoints the ideology that they're following.
Yeah, although I think we're getting to the point where when we're talking about terrorism and we do use the word jihadist, we all know that we're talking about terrorism and not someone like a regular Muslim who is just in some sort of like personal struggle to maybe be a better person. You know, it's almost like when you use the word militants, usually we're talking about some sort of terrorism group, but you could also use the word militants to talk about people in an organized, recognized military, but we never use it in that way. We're always talking about someone operating outside the law when we say militants.
Yeah.
So another question. You briefly mentioned Inspire versus Dabiq. Could you speak more about the different marketing, recruitment, and outreach strategies between the two groups?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is actually interesting because, I mean, I know a couple of times during the webinar, you know, we mentioned that Al-Qaeda's propaganda, their messaging is so bad, and ISIS is so engaging.
But
actually, when it comes to comparing these two magazines,
like
it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Inspire is usually very well put together. There's occasionally some spelling and grammar errors, but like the layout is phenomenal. It's very engaging. It's easy to read. It's nice.
Yeah, I agree. I'm the ISIS analyst and I'm ISIS all day, every day. But I mean, yeah, Dabiq one that's put out. Yeah, it's flashy. It's pretty. Graphics are great. No spelling errors. Academically written. Issued consistently. But when I read Inspire, I like it so much more. It's so much more interesting to read. Dabiq is so dull.
It's so boring.
And dry. But Al-Qaeda has a way of making it interesting. I mean, yeah, they've released 14 over the past 5 years for Al-Qaeda, but they're kind of they're definitely worth it.
So do not look for the 5-star review on Amazon. You can tell the analysts get very enthusiastic about their portfolios. So does ISIS have the infrastructure or flexibility to go underground should they be defeated in their current territory?
Ooh, good question.
Can I answer that one?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll jump in on that one. So I think, historically they did, right? So during the surge in Iraq that began in 2007 until they came back on the scene in 2013, they were an underground operation. And probably the best way to think about ISIS is you kind of got to think about them in two different ways. They are both a terrorist organization and an insurgency. And a lot of times when you hear discussions about them, they will mix those two things up. But they have both of those missions, and you can kind of separate them. So if they face overwhelming military pressure, their territory is destroyed, they will just retreat primarily to being a terrorist organization until they can rebuild their strength and move up into insurgency again. So in some ways, very much, if you're familiar with sort of insurgency theory, very similar to the Maoist model, where you sort of gradually move up the spectrum of sophistication and combat as you build capability. So do you think there's a paradox with ISIS where they lose more territory, they're facing more pressure on the ground, they'll feel more inclined or they'll feel more pressure to conduct external attacks?
Yeah, so I think we spoke to that a little where we've seen this before. Every time ISIS loses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, they revert to other means to either divert everyone's attention from that, to maintain momentum, and to still be able to say, hey, we're still doing something. So we saw this when they lost ground last year in the spring. They lost some territorial hold. And what they did was they bombed the two historical sites in Syria. And then we saw again when they started losing territory, they downed the Russian jetliner in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, the Paris attacks, we saw the Beirut bombings as well. In Lebanon, there was a Tunisian bus explosion as well, right within the same few days. Every time they are losing in on the ground, they will definitely amp up and increase external operations.
And the perception of momentum is just really important for them. More than Al-Qaeda, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's important because they want to make sure that they're still getting followers and recruits. They still want to make sure that they're defending and holding that vanguard, the title for the vanguard of the global jihadist movement.
Mm-hmm.
So, in essence, like, what's the deal with Al-Qaeda and their obsession with spectacular attacks? Like, it seems like they're always going for the Hail Mary pass. I don't know if that's a good analogy to use, but they're always going for the sort of high impact but low probability attack, as opposed to, let's gradually build, you know, let's do maybe smaller scale attacks and sort of wear your opponent out over time, as opposed to these big things. So do you guys have any thoughts as to why that may be?
I mean, I guess it's hard to know what they're really thinking, but I mean, in the 90s, they had a few, you know, really successful attacks when they attacked two American embassies in Africa and then attacking the USS Cole off the coast of Yemen. So I think maybe, you know, they were just able to carry out these relatively large attacks before anyone was really paying attention to who Al-Qaeda was and what they were doing. And so they got so much attention. So after you can conduct those three attacks and then you're able to conduct 9/11, it's almost like you have to keep going with those big, spectacular attacks. I mean,
they set the bar high for themselves.
They did. Yeah. They set a high bar. So even if they can get a couple guys, you know, in the middle of the United States to, you know, just conduct a small arms attack, it isn't very comparable to 9/11 or attacking a U.S. embassy. So I think they set the bar so high and they're just always trying to get back up to that level.
It is. And yeah, because everything else, after you do a 9/11, if you do I don't want to minimize it, but you do a mass shooting that kills five people, it's not in the same league.
Yeah.
And you become almost a victim of your own success.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I think ISIS will start to have to suffer from that too.
I think it's also Al-Qaeda's thing per se. So that was the thing, that spectacular attack defined them as a group after 9/11. ISIS is holding that territory and providing a state. That Islamic State is what defines ISIS, in conjunction with a number of other things, of course. But once ISIS starts losing that territory in the caliphate, it's going to deteriorate. So it'll have to constantly compete with holding that much territory if that starts to decline.
It's interesting as well is that you see this on a smaller scale when you look at homegrown violent extremists. Is for the longest time, up until fall of 2014, homegrown violent extremists, people inspired by, at that point, Al-Qaeda, all obsessed with spectacular attacks. I want the, you know, bomb loaded with 500 pounds of plastic explosives.
Mm-hmm.
And we always thought that was curious. We wrote to that at the time over a number of years, because we had sort of the Colorado theater shooting, we had the Sandy Hook shooting, and we thought, gee, this actually sort of lays out a template of how you could have a successful attack, but that didn't resonate very well with HVs. And even Al-Qaeda recognized that. And for a while, issued propaganda saying, look, stop trying to get bombs, go to a gun store and buy something because you're going to get caught otherwise. And HVEs weren't really interested in that.
No.
So there is, I do think there was probably a bit of strategy behind it. It certainly got America's attention. There's a bit of you're a victim of your own success. But I do think there is something also psychologically about striking the death blow, you know, doing the dramatic attack, you know. And I mean, it may be in our culture too. Maybe it's, you know, for us, Lexington and Concord, the shot heard around the world. It was that catalyzed the revolution. And, you know, everybody wants to be the one that makes history, right? Mm-hmm. And just want to be clear, I'm not equating 9/11 with the Battle of Lexington and Concord at all, but really in terms of sort of mentally where they are and how they might view sort of game-changing moments, that they all might be sort of obsessed with that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a way for ISIS to get shut down or cut off in terms of all the military supplies that they've captured over the past couple of years? A lot of U.S. military equipment, things like that. Is there a way to sort of shut them down to sort of prevent them from taking advantage of that?
of taking advantage of the weapons.
Yeah, that they've...
Well, either targeting ISIS strongholds with areas they know that they have weapons, which I can't speak to that, I don't know. But I do know that, I mean, I talk about this a lot, that, yeah, they've acquired so much U.S. military weapons and Russian weapons as well, but they can't militarily sustain themselves on this equipment for long. They don't have the capabilities or training to maintain or repair this equipment. So eventually, they're either going to have to use different weapons or acquire new weapons through future battle victories by acquiring the weapons from either the Iraqi security forces, etc.
Other than that, I'd like to take this advantage on behalf of Jenna and Angie to thank you very much for tuning in today and hope that you all found this informative. So thank you very much.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.